morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today is Double Eight Day, Second Millennium 24. My mind is melodically festooned with "In the Good Old Summertime," ringing through my weedy brain, circling my inner ears like a satellite. And it is, for me, I was born in the summer of Pearl Harbor year, in this Augustian month, 110 days from today. We are in the regal reign of Augustus, heir to Julius, a binary of 31 days each. Just as certain as cats chase dogs, August follows July, succeeded by falling leaves and harvest. I should remark on my neglect to earlier mention of the 55th anniversary of humanity's first stroll on another planet, Mother Gaia's own stepchild, Luna, on July 20th, 1969, which astronaut Buzz Aldrin described from its pitted surface, a magnificent desolation. And now, something I wrote for the extinct North Coast Times Eagle, Summers of Love and War. And I start with a quote by Abby Hoffman. "You cannot have change without the young. The young have the creativity. They have the energy. They have the impatience. You need the youth to descend." All sorts of people in late middle age are reminiscing about the summer of 1967, which they call the summer of love, a drug-induced hallucination in which several thousand, mostly pampered, middle and upper-class white flower children briefly abandoned social strictures and sang, danced, and fornicated like most of us imagine our wild and unfettered ancestors to have done in the primeval veldt before civilization and Christianity dampened our free-wheeling pagan spirits. Mecca, that legendary summer of 1967, was San Francisco, Baghdad by the Bay, historic incubator and refuge for many radical and eccentric mythologies. For an ephemeral moment in a nation torn apart by an unpopular war and racial strife, a quicksilver of fun and peace rippled through the stoned young masses who had swarmed into the city from all over the country with heads swaddled in blossoms, a song that summer urged westward-bound emigres, "If you go to San Francisco, wear a flower in your hair." An ad hoc socialist republic boomed and bust as rapidly as an old gold rush town. Everything seemed free for the asking. Food, lodging, medical care, sex, and wine. Even the psychedelic drugs that fueled the dreamlike vision of a world of harmony, peace, and love. It all went badly quickly, of course. Before the summer was over, evil spirits had merged with the blithe, frolicking throngs of nirvana seekers, stealing, assaulting, and raping, selling toxic drugs, and generally creating an infection of bad vibrations. The rhapsodies of nostalgia about that long ago and faraway summer seemed to ease over the ruthless struggles of that period. That same summer of 1967, American cities burned with racial hatred and insurrection, also despair. More than 200 other young Americans were dying in Vietnam every week, and God, Buddha alone, knows how many thousands of Vietnamese were killed between each Sunday and Saturday. The dream world itself soon darkened into nightmare. Two summers later, the counterculture grew from the summer of love produced its most famous citizen, Charles Manson. The 1960s are set apart from other decades. They are different not so much for their intensity. The World War II years were far more intense, or because they were flamboyant and colorful. The jazz age of the 1920s had more splash, or for that matter, because they were fueled by division and insurrection. The 1770s and 1860s make better claims. The significance of the 1960s is the example provided by the nation's indulgence in its youth, or perhaps more aptly, with a single immensely large generation of young people who responded by paradoxically souring on the nation at a time of unparalleled prosperity. The 1960s were a tumultuous period. The civil rights movement of primarily Southern blacks gave rise to a white civil rights movement of primarily disaffected youth who protested an unpopular and ill-conceived war that forced young males to fight and possibly be crippled or die. For the most part, the children of the working classes went quietly into induction and the war, and most of the nearly 60,000 dead and several hundred thousand wounded came from their homes. Primary opposition to the Vietnam War came from the nation's middle-class youth. As usual, upper-class whites were protected and could avoid service in the war, although many went into service, typically as officers, or were engaged in anti-war protest. Rampant ideologies and social solutions were conceived and died in the turbulent years of that decade. Revolution was a serious and futile flirtation, a malevolent and adolescent reaction against a paternal system that refused reform or criticism. Young Americans turned to animistic socialism. A new left replaced the old left and developed a political philosophy that loosely resembled gypsy law. They thought they could bind state socialism and social control with a tribal sense of individual freedom. The police and military showed the young resistors to authority that social change takes hard work and great pain, which few were inclined to exert. Reality, which means that all dreams take time for fruition and are modified by reality, disillusioned the young once more. The now generation found some other nows to be now about. A frustrated few tried to push against history, but were mostly killed or hunted into jail. Accidental explosion of homemade bombs literally wasted some of the best and brightest. If the 1967 summer of love and flower power was a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale for the young baby boomers, 1968 was surely a tale by the Brothers Grimm. It was a torrid year of assassinations, vainglorious battles in the overseas war, and increasingly violent anti-war demonstrations, generally set off by police and National Guards armed with clubs, guns, and gas. The presidential campaign failed to change anything. The new Republican administration that was elected despised the young protesters and attacked them more viciously than ever, 2 years later culminating in the shooting deaths of four white students at Kent State in Ohio and at least two blacks, both women, at Jackson State University in Mississippi. The government also staged a number of show trials of anti-war activists in the late 1960s and early 1970s, but juries acquitted them all. In 1969, anti-war radicals responded to police murders of Black Panthers and arrests of activists by forming a violent vanguard that proclaimed the beginning of revolution, the Weathermen, later Weather People, whose rhetoric was always considerably more revolutionary than their acts, and whose homemade bombs blew up in their faces. But 1968 was also a year when an international youth movement might have linked. Not since 1848 had Europe been so united behind barricades. France, West Germany, Czechoslovakia, the Prague Spring, and in Mexico at the 1968 Olympic Games, and Chicago, USA, on our side of the world. Revolutionary politics are saturated with hoped-for might-have-beens. No connection was made other than sympathetic, though often inflamed, oratory. In 1968, the war in Vietnam reached its most dramatic and painful peak, the Winter Tet Offensive by North Vietnamese armies and Viet Cong guerrillas, which included the long and bloody siege at Khe San, reminiscent of Dien Bien Phu 14 years earlier. 1968 was the moral low water mark of the war, the devastation of the ancient imperial city of Hue, and the slaughter of civilians by American soldiers at My Lai. President Lyndon Johnson surrendered his presidency to the war in 1968, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. sacrificed his life organizing poor blacks and whites against the economic system that impoverished them. Robert Kennedy, brother of the assassinated President John Kennedy, campaigned for the presidency on a promise to end the war and provide justice to the poor, and was murdered moments after victory in the California primary in June. In August 1968, a peak was also reached in the anti-war movement at the violent spectacle of the Democratic Party's National Convention in Chicago. The whole world was watching. Although the culturalists claim the 1960s got into swing around 1968, the theme of the decade was set at its start with the Black Civil Rights Movement. Not only did the violent and passionate search for racial justice inspire the later anti-war revolutionary New Left, earliest leaders of the movement were tempered by their own personal involvement in civil rights in the American South, registering blacks to vote, marching with blacks, and sharing the violent reaction. The other major influence was the Vietnam War, which provided the ignition point of youthful, mostly white rebellion, and added hardened veterans of the war to the largely college-oriented movement opposing it. The veterans, like the civil rights activists, were experienced with violence and capably reacted to attacks by police and state militias attempting to quell the revolt against national policy. The veterans who crossed political lines to oppose the war that seasoned and repelled them became immersed in leftist ideology, although many did not approve of it. Yet the political right had failed them, had inducted them into an unholy war cloaked in righteous deceit, made them prisoners of conscience. Whereas the early New Left had been inspired by the civil rights movement and embraced liberation philosophies, the veterans came into the anti-war movement angry and embittered. Most of the veterans had a limited focus that ultimately was fatal to their campaign, far short of its goal to end the war. Similar to the majority of New Left organizations, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, VVAW, was at first stimulated by argument, but eventually debate and disagreement degenerated into quarreling animosities that broke the group apart. All that survived were two mutually hostile splinter groups that orbited a far and exotic fringe. The U.S. government's most powerful counterstroke was to virtually end the military draft, which almost immediately diffused the rebellion. Draft age males, assured of avoiding combat service, lost interest in the immorality of the war, and also stopped thinking and talking about ideas and issues that grew from the war. Only diehards and incurable idealists persisted against the new wave of apathy driven by hopeful or grim visions. The new left dissipated into a pablum of new age kitsch. There were always contradictions among the countercultures of the 1960s. Hip culture chasing a buck in contrast to politicized hippies who wanted to abolish wealth. Nirvana seeking acid heads versus hardcore speed freaks and junkies. But everybody was against and in fear of the cops. The flower power dream of transcending materialism with goodwill failed, but not before it seeded the environmental movement and made ideas about pacifism, justice, and equality respectable. The most far-reaching legacy of the inspired and self-indulgent 1960s is the women's movement. The lingering problem, however, is that the fun-seeking nation adopted the sex, drug, and party habits of the young boomers, but not the philosophies or politics. Young Ben Braddock, as portrayed by Dustin Hoffman in the film version of The Graduate, written by Charles Webb, spoke for a disillusioned generation of baby boomers in early maturity when he said, "I don't know what I am, Dad, and I don't particularly care." Later, that spiritual emptiness would gorge on frenzied materialism, but for a short period, a large number of primarily affluent young Americans attempted to combat cultural nihilism with experiments towards a moral republic, which was to be lightly governed for the benefit of all persons by intelligent goodwill. Some among the large restless tribe that worshipped the image of eternal youth never got much older, swept up in the war that everyone seemed powerless to stop. A few endured jail to avoid the war or sought exile in other countries. Others resisted the war and defiantly braved guns, clubs, and disabling chemicals of police and National Guardsmen, many of whom enlisted in state militias to avoid service in the war. The drugs that opened the minds of thousands of alienated children seared them to ash in subsequent years. Although the baby boom generation temporarily repudiated the corrupt leadership and incessant greed of the nation, rapidly germinating and degenerating, dizzily heady ideologies and social solutions, it grew increasingly fond of the riches it had previously loathed. Most softened their resistance to the 7-11 values of their culture as they grew older. Communal patterns and politics were abandoned. Business networking among the former rebels replaced communalism. The happily acquisitive, workaholic, well-dined yuppie metamorphed from the angst-driven flower child hippie who thought universal love and open sex would make the world a better place. Yuppies contortedly justified their pursuit of wealth and status as fully compatible with their lingering sympathies for social justice. Now the baby boomers, who made so much trouble to their families and their country while they were growing up, or as old or older than their parents a generation and more ago. The war that traumatized their vulnerable youth is long over, although its residue continues to disturb amnesia. The psychopathic Cold War they grew up with ended abruptly with the collapse and disintegration of the Russian Communist Empire. The summer of love was the generation's iridescent mirage, the watershed of its vanished youth. They were born after World War II, and their memories don't include the daily sounds of bombers and bombs that tormented and killed children all over the world a few years earlier. Yet their continuing angst is a legacy of their parents' war. They were born under the sign of the mushroom cloud. More than the rebellion against prosperity and its flaccid corruption of spirit, their dread of nuclear holocaust defined their passionate protest against the Vietnam War, more even than personal fears of young males they would be drafted into it. This first nuclear generation, also the first television generation, felt a shared stake in the future, and apart from hype and herd instinct, they tried to be kind to one another. They are so large a generation, they crash through history as irresistibly as fire, remaking everything they sweep past. They are so accustomed to the attention of society, particularly its merchants, they believe they are the force of history itself. This is Michael McCusker. Jack Harris is this program's radio engineer today. If the grand old party of the Republic is either unwilling or incapable of coming up with another presidential candidate for president than the insufferable Donald Trump, whose previous single-term presidency is overwhelmingly considered the worst in U.S. history, despite a few contenders for that ignominious distinction, the GOP deserves to be roundly defeated this November and most likely should be either reformed or dissolved to give so-called third parties an opportunity to sit at the table with the big dogs. And I wish I believed in celestial retribution so that the recently deceased William Calley of My Lai, Vietnam infamy could meet with the murdered souls of his victims. And now, something else I have written. Children of Satan. I am left-handed, which is easier to be than in the past. Catholic nuns vigorously attempted to make me right-handed when I started school and accused me of being a son of Satan when I refused. I don't know why most people are right-handed, because they are. The right hand is the hand of sustenance and labor, and the vile left hand began its evil reputation in ancient times when it was used to clean away the body's excrement. Thus, from antiquity has developed a sophisticated aversion to the left side of things. Prejudice against people who are left-handed predates more familiar bigotries of race, religion, nationality, gender, and homophobia. In every culture before record, all that is good and righteous has been accorded the right hand, while everything evil, ugly, wrong-headed, or simply bad luck is the left. In politics as well as society, a crude bicameral cleft is made between right and left. The established order that resists change is the political and cultural right, which usually defends itself with tradition, religion, and autocratic power. The political left is the force of change and reform that calls upon the future instead of the past and explores new ideas and innovative social and political approaches to greater freedom and well-being of a common citizenry. Left is about justice, not privilege. The left is the opposition. Once in power, it automatically reverts to the right. The oldest struggle after survival is for freedom, of being a part of a community, not enslaved by it. The eternal, pitiless struggles between haves and have-nots, the despairing rage of those condemned to live bitterly wretched lives in the shadows and as menials to the economically and politically aristocratic elite who are in their turn angrily terrified by this rage. History shrieks with the pain of injustice, only briefly muffled by excesses of gross brutality. Sometimes the oppressed overthrow or forcibly reform their lords and bosses, but elites always rise in even the most originally classless societies. If the American Revolution is accepted as more than a revolt of colonial bourgeoisie, and that it gave birth to an essentially egalitarian society in which the common citizenry had a chance to be their own rulers, it should also be realized that every reform has been bitterly and often bloodily fought and adopted only with great reluctance. Reforms that have been adopted are usually countered with vicious backlash. For all the problems Western democracies have had with communism and socialism, words that mean community and society, when stripped of ideological abstraction, the ideas at their roots grew as alternatives to rapid industrialization in the 19th century, demanding in philosophy, if not practice, more than servitude for the mushrooming working classes as their share for producing the technological revolution throughout Western Europe and North America. Fascism and Nazism is an extreme right-wing reaction to these leftist heresies of class, i.e., social and political parity. That communist and socialist societies generally become totalitarian states of the political right should not repudiate the underlying perception shared with the democracies themselves, flawed and corrupt, that there is enough for everyone and everyone is equal under law. Reform, resistance, and rebellion to contemporary rule in the United States has, since at least the Russian Revolution, been called by assaulted authority leftist, a sinister, from Latin, sinus, meaning left or unlucky, hint at Bolshevik conspiracy, a suspicion of alien agents or homegrown dupes of foreign strategies to destroy the American way of life, operating within its very heart. In other words, dissent and resistance to authority and or injustice in this land of liberty and justice is implied to be treachery. Perhaps because of ancient and immediate hostility toward left-handed people, we are usually supporters of underdogs and outcasts and feel personally sympathetic to ideals of personal and political liberty. Left-handed people share with women and minority races and religions, not to mention people with physical and mental handicaps, the problems of survival in a world designed with no consideration for their presence in it, or much worse, designed to eradicate their presence.